Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In a move to mollify her supporters, the Obama campaign announced that rival Hillary Clinton's name will be placed in nomination at this month's Democratic convention. Former Virginia Governor Mark Warner will deliver the keynote. John McCain refused to rule out a pro-choice running mate, and a controversial new book about Barack Obama is the subject of a 40-page rebuke from the campaign. Joining me to talk about these stories and more, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek's Eleanor Clift, and Jim Engel with Fox News. We do invite your questions, comments during our Friday News Roundup. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, all.
Morning.
Morning, Diane.
Eleanor Clift, what does it mean that Hillary Clinton's name is going to be placed in nomination at the Democratic convention this month?
I think she recognized that the strong feelings among many of her supporters that if they weren't recognized through this traditional roll call vote, that there really could be problems in uniting the party. And in reading the stories this morning, she initially didn't support a roll call because she thought she would lose some delegates and she might appear to have less strength than she actually did win. But after meeting with her supporters and hearing from them, and they want to run television ads, you know, supporting her, they weren't going to back off. And I think, you know, the Obama campaign has also recognized, I think, that this is the way to do it. There is precedence, of course, and in 1976, when Mo Udall ran second to Jimmy Carter in a string of primaries, and he really was a sentimental favorite. He was a witty man, a charming man, and the Carter forces allowed him to put his name in nomination. But in 1980, when Ted Kennedy ran 600 delegates behind Jimmy Carter, but there was a lot of support for him on the convention floor, the Carter people didn't dare allow that to go because they thought it could be a runaway convention for Ted Kennedy.
Jim Engel.
Yeah, Clinton had said that her supporters still had a lot of pent-up feelings and needed a catharsis, at which point Obama said, I don't think we're looking for a catharsis. But as the situation continued to develop and you had Clinton delegates insisting that they were going to do something, whether the managers of the convention liked it or not, Obama decided to get out front and look like this, make this look like a parade, and give him some control over it. So now he can sort of anoint the Hillary Clinton campaign, celebrate it, and help to roll it into his, rather than have some sort of revolt at the convention that he is trying to stop. So it will work out much better for him and look much better.
Jerry Seib, will it bring the party together?
I think probably yes. I think it's probably a wise move by the Obama campaign. And I think, as Jim said, the idea of rolling these two enterprises together in sort of in the way, ideally, that Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush's campaigns got rolled together at the 1980 convention, contrary to a lot of predictions, that's the best outcome for the Obama campaign. And I think they're on their way to doing that. This probably is a good final step to making it happen. I doubt it'll get out of control, simply because Democrats, I don't think, are in a self-destructive mode overall this year. I think they're in a let's win it all this year mode, and that's quite different.
Why have they chosen former Virginia governor and current Senate candidate Mark Warner to give the keynote address?
Well, a couple of reasons, I would guess. One is that Mark Warner appeals to an audience that the whole convention is going to be designed to appeal to, which is middle class, working class, middle American white voters, the kind who made Mark Warner governor of Virginia and have helped turn that state to a state that's within reach for the Democrats, which goes to the second reason they've picked Mark Warner, which is the Obama people really would like to pick off Virginia this year. And they have every reason to think they can do it. And if they do it, if you look at the electoral map and you posit a close race, and honestly this looks at this point like it's a close presidential campaign, may not stay that way, but it looks that way now, you put Virginia in the blue category, a lot of things get much easier for the Democrats. And so that's the second reason, I suspect.
And what does that mean for Virginia's governor, Tim Kaine? Is he ruled out as a vice presidential candidate?
No, you know, people do all of this reading the entrails of animals, trying to figure out what one speaker means for another speaker and whether you can have two speakers from Virginia.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's sort of silly in a way. It doesn't mean anything. If he wants to pick Tim Kaine, the fact that Mark Warner is giving the keynote, I don't think makes any difference. The fact is, Virginia is key to them. The McCain political director this week said that you can't look at Virginia as a Republican state anymore. Mark Warner appealed to centrist Democrats, the kind of people that both these candidates would be fighting over. And Obama's going to be doing several stops in Virginia this weekend, and Tim Kaine is going to be campaigning for him and going door to door.
Well, Mark Warner is also a politician of the future. I mean, he flirted with running for the presidency himself. He could well be a candidate in the future. And if you really want to get Machiavellian, you could say it's an attempt to head off Hillary Clinton in 2012 or 16. And in terms of Tim Kaine, I think what factors against him now is the fact that the evening of the vice presidential nomination appears the theme is national security. Now, how would you pick somebody as your vice presidential candidate with no national security experience?
Does that tend towards Biden?
That seems to tend towards Biden.
Or
yes.
Biden.
Well, but
in my view.
But doesn't Biden have far more national security experience than Bayh?
No, he does. But on the other hand, Evan Bayh has another state, that Indiana, that I think the Democrats have notions of turning this year as well. And I think Evan Bayh's got enough national security experience because of his career in the Senate to make the case that he looks like a presidential, a legitimate president and a legitimate helper to a commander in chief.
Yeah, well, you would lose a Senate seat, though.
That's true. Well,
nobody's perfect.
That's right.
While it is true that Obama could, in fact, use someone who is a little heavier on national security credentials, the fact that it comes on the night that national security is the theme, I don't think is that limiting. Look, you can have all of that. They've got topics every night. You can have all of that and say, okay, the national security part is over, and now we move on to the most important part of the evening, the nominee for vice president. And so I don't see that that means you have to pick someone just because of the theme of the evening. The other interesting thing is the Obama campaign is allowing people to sign up for an email to get the vice presidential nominee. Supposedly it will all go out simultaneously so that everyone who signs up would get the announcement. They say that will be the first word. Now, I doubt very seriously that it won't leak to someone in the media first.
When
but
is
that what
expected, Jim?
Well, they don't tell you when.
They only tell you how.
It'll be a text message, and these are the people who are supporting his campaign and funding his campaign, and he doesn't want them to think they're just an ATM, that they're part of this. And so I think it's a very important signal, and again, telling the mainstream media how irrelevant we are.
Now, the other question is the platform that was agreed to Saturday. Any surprises there?
Well, you know, certainly a lot of discussion about the abortion plank, which seems to have been moved a bit back toward the Clinton era's abortion safe, legal, but rare, with emphasis on the rare. There's the language in there about taking steps to make the incidence of abortion lower, to put money behind that idea, and that I think initially caused some concern among the pro-choice forces in the party, but it appears that in the end everybody sort of fell together. I think it moves the party toward the center and Obama toward the center on a very sensitive social subject,
and
but not in a way that really makes anybody on the left angry, I think.
What about health care, Eleanor?
Oh, there was some to-ing and fro-ing, the differences between the the Clinton and Edwards plans proposed during the primaries and Barack Obama's, but I think they've smoothed that over as well. They want universal health care, and they're willing to compromise on the steps
to get
there.
And the platform mentions 18 million cracks in the highest glass ceiling.
The interesting thing about platform committee, I've covered some. I love them. Whether in either party, because you get all these people together and you see all of the fault lines within the party, all of the interest groups, all of those who have one view or another. Abortion is a good example, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. And it's a fascinating discussion. The problem is it doesn't matter at all. No one looks at the platform. They look at what the candidate is saying, and the candidate usually has a lot of influence over what the platform says.
Interesting that Senator Robert Casey is getting a primetime speaking slot, considering what you said about abortion, Jerry.
Yeah, I think both parties are trying to look a little less doctrinaire on the subject of abortion. I don't think the Republicans want to appear as if they are closing the door on pro-choice Republicans and Democrats. And Senator Obama himself, I must say, sound as if they really want to make it clear that you can be pro-life and a Democrat at the same time. And Casey is the best way to show
that's
it.
That's how the Democrats took back the Congress in part, by accepting different views.
And you've got John McCain campaigning with former Governor Tom Ridge this week. Any chance that McCain will choose Ridge, who is pro-choice, as his vice presidential running mate, Jim?
I don't think he'll choose him, but not because he's pro-choice. It's good for McCain from the campaign's perspective to talk about possibly and embrace people who are pro-choice for exactly the reasons Jerry was just citing. But I doubt that Ridge is the kind of person he needs. He's probably looking for someone younger, someone with a little more domestic stuff. McCain has all of the foreign policy, terrorism stuff all locked up. He needs someone who's stronger on the economy.
Jim Engel of Fox News Channel, Elner Clift of Newsweek, Jerry Seib at The Wall Street Journal. Short break and your calls when we come back, 800-433-8850. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup this week with Newsweek's Elner Clift, Jim Engel of Fox News Channel, and Jerry Seib. He's Washington Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. There's a book about Barack Obama making a lot of news. What can you tell us, Jerry Seib, about The Obama Nation by the same fellow, Jerome Corsi, who was co-author of a book attacking the 2004 presidential nominee for the Democrats, John Kerry?
Well, it's a book that's become both instantly famous and controversial this week. It alleges a lot of things about Barack Obama, many of which don't seem to be true, including that he's really a Muslim, that he's got a Muslim agenda that he's planning to enact, and that there was a lot more radical activity in his background that he's essentially hidden. This is the same guy who wrote the book about Swift War veterans that undermined the John Kerry campaign in 2004. The Obama campaign, I think, initially wasn't sure how to respond. They just sort of let it lie there for a few days. But by the middle of the week, the book was at the top of the New York Times bestseller list, was attracting a lot of attention. And so on Thursday, the Obama campaign posted on a website it maintains to respond to attacks, a 40-page rebuttal, which is now there for everybody to go see, which goes through a lot of these charges bit by bit, pointing out, among other things, that the book gets Obama's wedding date wrong, and some details about his personal life that should be easy to validate are incorrect, as a way of trying to undermine the whole enterprise.
And why has Mary Madeline put her imprint on this book, Jim Ankle?
Mary Madeline is a conservative and a Republican, and I assume she thinks it's a good idea. And not only that, that it will make money. But look, the thing that's different about this and the Swift Boat attacks is that the Swift Boat veterans did television ads. You know, even when a book is number one, the vast majority of voters do not read it. They hear about reports on it. When the book hit number one, you get a lot of media reporting. There was a report on Morning Edition this morning, for instance. You get a lot of media reporting so that those notions get out there, even if people dispute them as the reporting goes on. The problem for Kerry was that he never really attacked those things in a head-on, frontal way. What you have now with the Obama people, who have not been subject to ads yet but do have the book out, is they have come out with howitzers and a 40-page rebuttal. And as Jerry said, they weren't quite sure what to do, but they have decided that the John Kerry method of just saying, it's not true, would not work for them.
Elner.
I don't know that a 40-page rebuttal on a website is exactly a howitzer. I mean, I think the Obama campaign is caught in this classic trap, and he's trying to run a different kind of campaign. He doesn't want to get down and respond to this sort of stuff. If he doesn't, it's out there, and people believe what they hear repeatedly. And the polls show that a substantial number of people in both parties, I think it's 12% Republicans, 12% Democrats, believe that he is a Muslim, and that it's the part of the theme of running against him is that he's not he's got other agendas. He's got these ties with the left that he's concealed, that he's out of the mainstream, and I think it fits into the Republican case against him, not one that John McCain makes directly, but makes subliminally. I mean, the first McCain commercial said, "The American president Americans are waiting for," as though somehow the other candidate might not be, quite so American. So I think this is very, very dangerous territory.
Well, dangerous in the sense that Jim Engel, you mentioned Morning Edition, did a report on this. There is an editorial in this morning's Washington Post about this book. Seems to me that the media has a responsibility to really hit back on this book, not just for the Democratic nominee, but for the truth.
Well, sure. I think the media always has a responsibility to the truth. I think the reality of this environment is that the mainstream media's ability to either clarify or rebut anything that's in the environment is severely limited by the fact that lots of people are going to the internet, going to websites, finding information that reinforces their preconceived notions, and then taking that to the bank. I mean, that is just the reality of running a political campaign in the year 2008. And the Obama campaign knows that, the McCain campaign knows that, and honestly, so do all these outside groups. And I think it's just a different environment and not necessarily a pretty one.
Right. I think it's lousy.
Right. Well, these rumors can become viral, to use the term of the day, and people look at it and they think, well, all that smoke, there must be some fire.
Here's an email from Edward in Tallahassee who says it's to his credit that Senator Obama's campaign has responded forcefully to the slanderous falsehoods that Jeremy Corsi freely admits are designed to derail Obama's presidential run. The only fear I have is that media organizations will dwell on this meaningless diatribe in much the same way they did in 2004. How does your panel anticipate the media response to this latest effort at swift booking? Jim.
Well, in the way that we were just talking about, you will have people who will take it up. And this was the reason the Obama people put out the 40-page rebuttal, is so that when people do pieces on this, which they're bound to do, they will have something. They can go to the Obama document and say, aha, he says, of course he says this. The Obama campaign responded by saying, that is not true, and here's why.
But
you
we're
give them
not,
ammunition.
Okay, but we, as part of the media, are not without guilt if we simply talk about this book as though, you know, it's a phenomenon.
Well, no, that's
true. But you can't ignore it either.
No,
and
of course not.
I agree, we feed the beast. But now I think then it's up to the Obama campaign, even though Senator Obama has been running for almost 2 years, people still really say repeatedly they don't know enough about him. And that's going to be a theme of the Republican campaign. We don't know enough about him. So the onus is now on the Obama campaign and Obama to really press his life story. And that's what the convention is going to be about. And then it's also going to be about, okay, he wants change. Change from what? And he's got to document, you know, all the ills of the Republican years. And the convention is an important time for him to get himself across without the media clutter. It's his time, and I think it's, you know, people are really going to be looking.
Is the public in a different place now from what they were in 2004 as they see these kinds of vicious diatribes coming forth, Jerry?
Well, I'm not sure, and I think we'll find out. I mean, one of the things you have to keep in mind in about 2004 was there were a lot of stories that took apart the Swift boat ads and book, and essentially said the guys who were speaking up represented a minority and were offset by some people who were vociferous defenders of John Kerry. That didn't stop the Swift boat, the juggernaut, from rolling on all the way through November. I'm not sure if the American public is in a different place. I think it is where Eleanor described it, which is to say it's intrigued by Barack Obama, but not yet convinced that he has the kind of background and values that they can identify with. That's the question they want answered, much as they had the same question about Ronald Reagan in 1980, frankly. What's different, I think, is the media environment in which voters hash through all of that, and that is quite different now than 2004 and certainly 2000.
I think the Obama campaign believes people are better able to weigh these things. But in a way, Obama has fed into this by, I don't think, offering enough in terms of a substantive vision other than the vague change. And so he is now, it's like he's running on his biography and on himself. And so if you begin to find chinks in that armor, he's in trouble. So he's got to not only reinforce his life story, which is a very American story, he's also got to flesh out exactly what kind of change he would bring and give people a little more to hang their votes on other than Barack Obama as a phenomenon.
All right, let's talk about Nancy Pelosi, who may allow a vote on offshore drilling after all. What should we expect, Jim Engel?
Well, she is quoted this morning as backing off that a little bit and saying that she would not allow a separate vote on offshore drilling because it is a hoax. So if you believe it is a hoax, then why would you include it in a package? She initially suggested she might include it in a package because she was going to combine it with things that she knew Republicans could not vote for. So I think she is not going to allow a vote, certainly not a straight-up vote on offshore drilling, but trying to deal with this issue. This has been a really difficult issue for Democrats because in all the opinion polls, you get 60, 65, 70, more than 70% of the people who say, let's drill more. People want to do everything. They want greener cars. They want renewable energy. And they want more oil because and gas because whatever we do on the renewable front, will not take us off our reliance on oil for many, many years. So everybody wants everything, and Nancy Pelosi's been stuck in a very difficult spot on this and tried to throw this out as a way of saying, well, we might allow this. And,
well,
of course, you had Obama who did the same thing.
The LA Times is reporting this morning that one anonymous House leadership aide said, quote, one proposal being considered would let states decide whether to permit new energy exploration off their coasts while possibly maintaining the drilling ban off the Pacific coast, Jerry.
Yeah, that's probably the kind of artful compromise Democrats would like to get to. I mean, look, for some weeks now, some Democrats in the House have thought they are not in a good position on this, that to say no, 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 in an environment in which Americans were going around spending twice as much to fill their tanks with gas this summer than they expected to was not a good position to be in, and that they needed to get off of it somehow and to find some way off of it. So, therefore, the Nancy Pelosi view, which just said we're not even going to have a vote on it, started to become a little more out there than a lot of Democrats wanted to be. One of the compromises they talked about earlier, and in fact talked about a lot eventually, was, look, let's do more. Let's compel the oil companies to do more drilling on leases they've already acquired. And that worked for a while, but it hasn't stopped polling that says Americans basically are becoming more favorable to the idea of offshore drilling.
And
so Democrats have to get out of that position.
And Republicans, it seems to me, have use this issue, whereas, in fact, all the reports, the Government Accountability Office says very little is going to come from that offshore drilling.
Right, and it would be 10 years away. I mean, it seems to me just kind of a cheap slogan, and people are responding almost reflexively, but the entire House of Representatives is up for re-election, and there are a lot of Democrats who can't sustain a position against drilling and worry about getting re-elected.
And
she's responding to that.
And the Republicans have threatened to close down the government, Jim?
Well, Senator DeMint has a letter about blocking appropriations if, in fact, they don't move forward on energy things. I doubt very much it will come to that.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's take a call from, let's see, Skaneateles, New York. Let's go to Ken. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. It's Skaneateles, New York, which is in the beautiful Finger Lakes region.
I'm sorry. I couldn't read that correctly. Forgive me.
That's fine. Thank you for letting me ask a question. You've moved off the issue of running mates, but I'd like to come back to it very quickly and ask, how come no one has discussed the possibility of Bill Richardson being a running mate for Obama? He seems to have a lot of complementary experience and background that would fill in some gaps in Obama's campaign. That's my question, and I'll get your response.
All right. Thanks for calling. Is Bill Richardson being considered?
Well, who knows? You know, I thought earlier this year, I thought Bill Richardson was the model vice presidential candidate in some ways for either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, but he seems to have fallen off the radar screen. You know, it may be that there are a lot of possible reasons. One of them may be that the Obama campaign may conclude that the first African-American candidate and the first Hispanic candidate combined on a ticket is a little too much change for even this year of change. But who knows? I mean, maybe he's on the short list and we just don't know. Whatever it is, there was a lot of discussion about Bill Richardson earlier, not much now.
What was your reaction to the news about the John Edwards affair, Eleanor?
Well, my initial reaction as a woman and as a person was, what a cad. But this is more than what you might call simple infidelity. I mean, all the other layers, the payments to the various people involved. And this morning, the New York Times has a front page piece about the lawyer connected to John Edwards who was making payments that allegedly John Edwards wasn't aware of, and that he had ties to the lawyers representing the woman plus the former Edwards aides who's declared himself the father. I mean, and you know, the tabloids are just not going to let go of this, and mainstream media has found it to be quite a compelling detective story. And you wonder, what were the Edwards thinking? I mean, if Elizabeth Edwards was aware of this when they embarked on the presidential campaign, I imagine she thought, it was a case of infidelity, and that
what is that?
We could get through it. But there's so much more to this, and the enormous sympathy that people feel for Elizabeth Edwards makes this especially poignant.
Well, for one thing, Democrats have to be thinking, boy, did we dodge a bullet on this one. Can you imagine if he were the nominee? It would be a complete disaster. The thing that now appears is that the relationship was longer than he admitted, that it was a far more elaborate arrangement with payments to her and even getting more money to pay her sometime after her work finished, and other funds going to them, and the very close associate of Edwards getting lawyers for her and getting money donated to her and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, the other thing was, I mean, he comes out and he says in acknowledging this, he says, well, you know, let me just point out, this was when my wife's cancer was in remission. Well, what possible difference could that make? I mean, it was one thing, and I heard several women commentators just seething at the notion that he would even introduce that into the explanation. So it is a very unseemly affair.
Well, sad is the word that comes to mind. I mean, a family that that lots of Americans wanted and did love because of the many poignant aspects of the family story. Now you're left with this.
And it is a story that is going to mean he's out of politics, certainly for the foreseeable future. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, your emails and your phone calls, 800-433-8850. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, and by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Russian forces remain in Georgia despite a promise to pull back. Secretary of State Rice travels to Tbilisi in a show of support for the Georgian government, and Pakistani President Musharraf tries to avoid impeachment. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back with your phone calls, your email. Let's go first to Edgemont, Arkansas. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I've been listening to your show for years, and I love it.
Thank you so much.
I heard a shocking radio broadcast last evening that was religious affiliated, and they said that if Obama were elected, abortions would be rampant. Gay rights we'd see gays running through the streets, and that human rights would be curtailed. I just couldn't believe my ears. When
I certainly understand your feeling, Jim Engel. Is this what we're going to see in this campaign?
I don't know. I didn't see that. I don't know who that was from. It's hard for me to imagine someone would say gays will be running through the streets and that sort of thing.
It's not an ad. It was a radio broadcast.
Oh, you mean it was a commentator?
Well, it was a group discussion from several religious-affiliated people.
Okay. Yeah, you will hear, you can hear anything you want to on radio, as you know. I mean, it is a big, big community, and people with lots of different views, many of them uncharitable about people they disagree with.
Well, the pollsters always poll on, you know, does this person share your values? Does this person identify with people like me? And these are the attributes that are going that the opposition is going to try to turn against Obama, that he somehow doesn't share traditional values because he has exotic is kind of the code word. Somehow Hawaii, even though it is a state in the union, is regarded as exotic. And I think, you know, this is the kind of language we're going to hear a lot of between
Jerry,
now and November.
On another point completely, let's talk for a minute about the thing that's on everybody's mind, and that's the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And the inflation rate in this country rose to a 17-year high. And at the same time, average weekly workers adjusted for inflation, their wages fell by 8%. What's going on
there? Well, you know, it's alarming and not alarming at the same time. People have been wondering for months, but knowing for months that eventually the price pressures from higher energy prices would start to ripple through the system, and that's what happened, and it's made worse by the fact you've also had, and the two aren't entirely unrelated, higher food prices at the same time, a lot of higher commodity prices. So what you saw in these new figures was alarming on the one hand, but totally predicted and predictable on the other hand, which is finally you're seeing the ripple effects of the energy prices and the higher food prices coming through the system. You know, interestingly, the stock market looked at that and was sort of nonplussed by it, didn't react. So I think people saw it coming. The only question really is, how long is this factor going to continue? That's important for a lot of reasons, not the least of which it will determine whether the Fed has to respond to higher inflation and raise interest rates, which it clearly does not want to do and is looking for reasons not to have to do.
There is also a lot of talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Alan Greenspan's statement that somehow it ought to be nationalized. What does that mean, Jim Engel?
Well, it would mean that the federal government, instead of having a once or twice removed relationship, these are government-sponsored enterprises, that it would essentially take them over. Probably a pretty bad idea and one that is not likely to win many salutes in Congress. It is far better, and you have a lot of key Republicans and Democrats who have worked on this, who think they have a workable solution for the moment, but no one ever knows, you know, how this is going to unravel. But it is, Greenspan also says that he sees a bottom to the housing drops sometime early next year, which would, you know, at some point stop the bleeding.
Eleanor?
I think when you talk about nationalizing something, there's sort of an ideological aversion. So that's probably not going to happen. But they might as well be nationalized because they have the full strength and credit of the American government behind what they do. And we've discovered that they've run it pretty fast and loose without any government oversight. And now we're paying the price. So I think you will see the Congress trying to short a leash on these institutions.
What would that mean for shareholders?
Well, I think the Greenspan message was that the government should have just let the shareholders take the bath. You take the risk, you pay the price. Just a footnote, though, his actual proposal and what most people say when they talk about nationalizing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is the government nationalizes them, breaks them up, and sells them back eventually and not too much farther down the road to private investors. So not keeps them in perpetuity, but gets them off the market, breaks them into smaller pieces that aren't so dangerous to the economy, and sells them back to private investors in that form.
Why can't Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do that right now?
Well, they could, but
But they're not able to.
Well, not now, not in the condition that they're in right now.
Exactly.
That's the point. And the government would need to rescue them before it could then save them and make them viable in the private sector in
All
a
right.
different form.
Let's go to Frisco, Texas. Good morning, Bernie. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. One of the two gentlemen made the comment that Senator McCain had the foreign policy concept of skills sewn up. The only reason he has it sewn up is that the mainstream media, of which I think the three of you are part of, has let him get away comparatively scot-free with one mistake, one inane statement, and after the other, including the most recent about the situation in Georgia with Russia, that in the 21st century, one country does not invade another. And he is a man in favor of the Iraq War and continuing to be in favor of it. So this guy doesn't have foreign experience or foreign service experience or foreign expertise. He's just being allowed to get away with what he does.
I think he's talking about you, Jim Engel.
Possibly. aside from this gentleman's comments, there are very few people who do not see McCain's strengths, if you are a McCain supporter, as his experience and long involvement in foreign policy and military affairs. What we were talking about was his vice presidential pick, and whether you pick someone who has a similar portfolio or someone with a different portfolio, such as domestic policy and the economy.
On the question of Georgia, doesn't McCain have someone in his campaign who has a relationship with the state of Georgia?
All right. His top aide, Randy Schuneman, has been a paid advisor, lobbyist for the state of Georgia. And there are some pretty clear conflicts of interest there, I think. But I imagine that Senator McCain would still be a big booster of Georgia, even if this gentleman were not on his on his staff. And it's being seen as a way to prove his toughness on the campaign trail, when in reality the positions of McCain and Senator Obama on what's happening in Georgia are essentially the same. They're both urging the diplomatic track. But McCain has called for ousting Russia from the G8, and he called for that, you know, months ago, and he's now trying to claim that that's a prescient call. I think it's a very wrongheaded call, but that will be disputed over the coming months.
Jerry.
Well, it sort of framed an interesting foreign policy debate, I think, which is, to overstate it, is whether Barack Obama is too soft and John McCain is too reckless. I mean, that's kind of the picture that came into sharper focus this week.
Let's now go to Fort Worth, Texas. Bach, you're on the air.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Good.
I just had a comment. You know, first, I'm Muslim. And I'm from, born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas, and, you know, Muslim is not a race of people, for one. You know, we all don't come from a place called Muslimovania or something. You know? and two, you know, I keep hearing this. I think it's very hypocritical for us and how us as a country can say that we have this freedom of religion and that's all okay unless he, you know, you try to run for president. And it's a strong argument against him that a lot of people are using that he's a secret Muslim. And I'm like, okay, so what happens if he do get in office? And he turned out to be a Muslim. You know, do we impeach him for lying, or what if he changes his religion? You know, I just think it's very hypocritical for us to say we are this free country, we have this freedom of religion, as long as you don't run for president as a Muslim, you know?
Jerry.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, we've been through this. You know, John Kennedy, could a Catholic be president? Joe Lieberman, could a Jew be vice president? Barack Obama, well, he's not a Muslim, but what if he were a Muslim? Could he be president? I mean, you know, should it matter? Probably not. Does it matter? Sure. But, you know, in American history, these sort of hurdles have been popping up and then getting cleared in some succession.
Let's go now to Pinehurst, North Carolina. Keith, hi there. Yeah.
Good morning. There was an article in the Huffington Post this past week about John McCain's affair of some 30 years ago, and I'm just wondering why he's getting a free ride on that when, you know, Edwards has taken all this bashing in the press.
Elton Hurd.
Well, I think for one thing, it was 30 years ago, and the Edwards affair is much more recent. John McCain's former wife apparently has a McCain sign in her yard, so it's not like there's ongoing enmity. And it just doesn't, you know, John McCain has a strong brand, and that brand is one of a war hero. And I think you can print a lot of this negative stuff that reflects badly on his character, but it doesn't really hurt him.
All right. To Ed in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Are you there?
Yeah. Hi, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Actually, if I can go back two callers, he mentioned McCain saying about Russia going into Georgia, and he was equating it to the same situation as the United States going into Iraq. And I'm surprised no one on the panel jumped on that, because it's not. Saddam Hussein was a dictator, was not democratically elected. So it's a totally different situation, if they can comment on that.
This country has particularly high moral ground when it comes to lecturing another country about going in. And Russia has a set of definitions of its own as to why it was responsible on their part. And I think the analogy they make is actually to Kosovo, when the United States went in without UN approval and went in and intervened in the Kosovo situation. So you don't have to agree with it, but you can see their rationale.
Yeah, there is a distinction here, because obviously the United States had for 15 years a difficult relationship with Saddam Hussein, as did the international community. Remember, Clinton bombed Saddam Hussein during his administration. You had all sorts of disputes. You had no-fly zones. You had lots of difficulties. So
well, there have been difficulties between the Russians and the Georgians, too.
Well, yeah, because the Georgians are now independent, and they don't like it. And they don't like other independent nations around them. They don't like the fact that the Soviet Empire crumbled and that all of the former Soviet bloc and all of the Eastern European nations are now free and want to be part of the West.
But it is over those two disputed areas, and the two disputed areas do owe their allegiance to Russia. Again, I'm not saying you have to agree with the Russian thinking, but you can understand what it is.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Medford, Oregon. Good morning, Barbara.
Oh, good morning, all. I remember John McCain saying at the beginning of this campaign that, you know, the American people are tired of all this negative ads and negative campaigns, and I just don't understand why the Republicans always seem to want to knock someone's head off in order to grow a foot. And then also, too, I am so irritated at Senator Graham for saying that middle-class people are whiners. It just really irritates me. I just can't seem to get off of that.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jerry.
Well, I think the McCain campaign would love it if you could forget that Senator Graham comment, first of all. Second of all, it has gotten kind of nasty on the McCain side. The ads got pretty tough in the last week. I can only assume that their view is that Senator Obama is getting a pretty easy pass with the press, and so if anybody's going to knock him down, cut him down to size, it'll have to be us directly, and that's what's going on. But it is somewhat at variance with the McCain persona that was out there for so long and that he did a fair amount to cultivate himself.
And to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. I wanted to draw an analogy between offshore drilling and balloon payments on mortgages. Both offshore drilling and a retooling of the nuclear industry would postpone and distribute the pain that we really ought to grapple with right now by conservation. And the analogy with the balloon mortgage is you sort of go along in a fantasy world thinking that you can afford payments, which then later down the road balloon and cause you to lose your home. In the case of both offshore drilling and unsafe nuclear power, which is not sustainable except by massive government subsidies, we have a situation that's very similar, where we're postponing the pain of conservation, postponing the pain of investing in newer technologies that are sustainable, like solar and geothermal and so forth.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call. Jim Engel.
Well, that is a pretty good summary of one viewpoint, certainly in Congress, and probably Nancy Pelosi's view, which is that if you drill for more oil and find more oil, we will use it. You drive down the price, and people will simply use it, and it will take off the pressure to look for alternatives. Look, when you got oil to 100...
We won't necessarily use it. It's going to go on the world market.
Exactly.
Well, no, but oil is a global market. But if where there is more oil and the price is lower, the fear is that we will simply use it, and it will take the pressure off to find alternatives. When oil got to 150, you had all sorts of things coming to the fore because they may not have been cost-effective before, but they were at $150 a barrel oil. So the notion here of a lot of people is, as she said, if we find more oil, we will postpone the pain that is necessary to make the transition.
Well, and opponents to drilling probably should make the case that we're just feeding China's thirst as opposed to really making ourselves more independent.
Of course,
delayed gratification has never been a popular notion in a democracy.
I hear people saying that the free market is working with people driving less, consuming less. What about speculation? Has that somehow subsided in the oil market?
Well, there's fear that Congress is going to act, and I think there'll be some sort of a crackdown. Well, so I think there's been some sort of voluntary pulling back.
Manipulation is already illegal. Speculation is a different thing. You have truckers, airlines, all of whom speculate and buy futures. Somebody has to take the other side of that bet, and you now see oil coming down. So speculation, obviously, it works both ways.
Jim Engel of Fox News Channel, Eltner Clift at Newsweek, Jerry Seib at The Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Emily Robichaud answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.